previously on the XNHT Speakeasy.
I notice there's still blood sort of just on the glasses, just that top right hand corner.
That's always the difficult part to arrange with those wipes. Because hey, who likes to write?
Oh man, that writing is so dull.
Jake Gyllenhaal.
Oh yeah, Gyllenhaal.
Gyllenhaal. That's... See, this is exactly
be
right.
Be careful with that pronunciation. You will
Gyllenhaal.
Get your, Gyllenhaal. You will get your head snapped off in certain circles if you mispronounce that.
Because this podcast is actually a remake of a 1964 Armenian radio show, isn't it?
Oh yes.
Something we've been trying to keep under our hats, but you know, the Speakeasy was Armenia's, you know, biggest radio show, and we got, you know, all those bootleg tapes, and basically we've just been rehashing the same old material.
People are saying, what was the point? They're actually comparing it to the Gus Van Sant version of Psycho. That it's literally in points, it's shot for shot.
And those of you playing a drinking game at home, that was egregious, so that means you get to down two shots, as we know, because Rob tries to get that word into every podcast.
Yeah, it has to be done.
It has to be done.
Yeah.
I put my teeth in there.
Yeah, please do. December, as we hit peak mass consumer intake, all good yeomen and true gather round to watch the new John Lewis advert. Me, I'm too busy with my preparations for Saturnalia. The Holly codpiece is coming along nicely. I am Rob Wickens.
Je suis Clive Asherden, it's music time on the Speakeasy as we explore, with a witty nod to last month, the world of the cover version. We're helped immeasurably in our exploration by a special musical guest, The Little Unsaid, aka John Elliott, who will be helping us pick our way through the good, the bad and the downright surreal.
Strum me like a banjo. It's the XNHT Speakeasy.
Big fanfare.
Yay.
Yay. So, hello and welcome. And we should also say that we have a special additional guest in the form of Mr. Alex Perkis. We've actually gone all professional and got some kind of audio engineer set up.
It's very professional here in Studio 2A. Not in the Bleeding Heart of Soho this month. We're... old streety kind of a way.
We are in a hidden bunker in Clerkenwell.
Yes, and it's all very professional here. We have mics up the wazoo. We have digital recorders. We have a musician.
We've got a special bin mic stand.
Yeah. Oh yes, the bin mic stand, specially designed for that extra acoustic magic.
It is all about the magic. And yeah, I'm really excited to have John on the show. He will be piping in later, but before we get to that, we're just going to kind of sort of tie up some last month.
Yes, wanted to thank everyone again for the fantastic contributions to last month's Facebook discussion on remakes.
Thank you very much.
Actually, we've still got stuff. Stuff is still coming in. There is still love for the remake of Assault on Precinct 13, which I still find quite mind-boggling, and for The Italian Job. Why?
How about that?
And apparently, Clive, we issued a spoiler last month.
Yes, we've had our knuckles roundly slapped by more than one person. I believe there was a heinous spoiler for Star Trek Into Darkness. I mean, I don't think it was one of us who actually issued this one. It may have been our special guest from last month, Mr. Simon Aitken.
Well, when in doubt, always blame the absent guest, I say.
But you know, he's a rebel. He just doesn't care what we say.
To be fair, we were spoiling. Here I am doing inverted commas in the air.
Yeah, air quotes, man.
Air quotes.
That works on Wave, yeah.
It does. Spoilers for something that's out on DVD Blu-ray, really?
I think there are people who are very sensitive, aren't there, to any kind of world of spoilers. This idea that, you know, no matter, there's always going to be one person who is going to be their first time watching Star Wars, so they won't know that Darth Vader is X. You know, they won't know that thing that everybody knows. And so if you say it, they're like, oh man, you've totally ruined that film for me. So we will try in future to be a bit sensitive. I mean, when we do our reviews, we're very careful to avoid spoilers.
Oh, absolutely.
But in certain discussions, I think we'd probably say today, I mean, can you spoil a song by talking about cover versions? It's like, oh, what? It's got trombone on it.
Oh,
it spoiled it for me. I was waiting for that surprise of the trombone.
What on earth is that chorus doing there? For goodness sake. No, I think we're on safer ground, so...
I think we're okay.
Yeah, apologies to anyone whose delicate sensibilities we did stomp all over with our size 10s, but, you know.
Okay, but enough apologising. I think it's time to move on to...
The Dice of Fate.
The Dice of Fate. This month we are doing the 52nd Flash Music Blog Challenge.
Oh, yes. This was Clive's idea. Clive suggested that we listen to a right selection of music blogs and from that get ourselves some interesting new music recommendations.
Yes, yeah, expand our horizons, try different things, maybe different genres than we normally get into.
Yeah.
And, yeah, because obviously it can be easy to get stuck into a kind of rut with things you're listening to. Especially if you only listen to certain radio stations or, mm-hmm. you know, you're getting your recommendations through certain places again and again, you can just almost predict the kind of thing you're going to be listening to. And we don't like that.
We like new things. We like to keep it interesting and different. So, subsequently, that's what we've done. This month, I did actually do what I was told as opposed to my own way, and I did actually listen to the music blogs and read the music blogs, listen to the music blogs that I was supposed to. So, yay me.
Yay me as well. We've been following 5 blogs each.
Right. 2, 3, 4. Yes, it is 5.
Yes, it is 5. Yes, yes. 5 blogs each. And so, the idea is that we're going to, in our 50 seconds, we're going to just recommend a few kind of highlights and just give a flavour of the blog and whether we'd recommend it.
Absolutely. Okay. So, for those of us, if there's anyone still new to the concept, the 50-second challenge is exactly what it says on the tin. We have 50 seconds to talk about our chosen subject.
We are under the clock, so brevity is a necessity.
Oh, someone's been thinking about what they've been doing.
Either too much coffee.
Brevity is key, yes, and there's no such thing as too much coffee. I thought I told you that. Okay, I'll start, and I shall start with the enemy. Still remarkably heavy on the sort of echo-drenched epic indie I used to like back in the 80s. So, really, it's strangely, comfortingly familiar for a so-called new music blog. Few highlights. I liked Ballet School's Crush, which, if you imagine a slightly noisier Sunday, so we're always a slightly noisy Cocteau Twins, that's the kind of sound you're going for there. Royal Blood's Come On Over. Scuzz Rock, Sweat, Leather Trousers, lots of low-end throb, you know what I'm saying. See Pink's Magpie's Eyes, which was DB's Let's Active Style Jangle Pop. And Courtney Barnett's Milk, sped up Massey style with a lazy Mockney girl voice over the top. Not bad. Next up is Mr. Clive.
Next up, and let's start with Pitchfork.
Pitchfork.
Yes, it's the hipster Bible, and it has its own kind of music blog where you get several tracks each, new tracks and new music each day. The writing here is kind of clever, but my God, I found this incredibly pretentious and just really irritating.
Pitchfork? Pretentious?
Yeah. Willfully obtuse selections that largely avoid melody of any kind. A good example is something like Kimi No by Insular, a 24-minute mix of 17th-century poetry, Anatolian folk rhythms, and electronica. So you won't be hearing this stuff on the radio. On a more positive note, something good would be something like Beloved by Say Lulu.
Okay.
So, no, don't go there.
Me up next. No Country for New Nashville, which is a site highlighting the sounds coming out of Music City that aren't country. strange but true, there is some, but for the most part, that music seems to be retro country rock indie of the ilk of the last breakout rock act from Nashville, that is the Kings of Leon. So most of the stuff that they're actually pushing on the site does sound like Kings of Leon outtakes. If you like that sort of thing, that's fine.
Do you like that sort of thing?
It all got a bit tedious, to be brutally honest. Also, the site is heavily skewed towards the live scene in Nashville, so if you're not within driving distance of Nashville and its clubs, it's all going to be a little bit alienating and, frankly, a little bit redundant. So, there you go. Mr. Clive.
Top house music blog.
Oh, baby.
Yeah. This is one of those ones which is totally new to me. I really don't listen to much house or dance music generally. I mean, I tend to think that stuff works best in a club. But this is a real nice surprise, really. You get lots of free downloads of new mashups and remixes. It's completely unpretentious. A real joyous celebration of house and dance music. I was surprised by how much I got into this. There's some highlights there, stuff like Steve French by Flux Pavilion featuring Steve Aoki. Through the Night by Botneck, the Snails remix, which is a free download. And Machines by John Twigg and Crowfield, another free download.
Bang it. I'm up next with Breaking the Waves. When a blog features bands with names like Snowbird, Elderbrook, Meadowlark and Hayes, you know you're not in for a feast of blazing metal or in-your-face hip-hop. Breaking the Waves focuses on dream pop, down-tempo electronica and girly folk. It's all very nice, perfectly soothing, professionally written, but after a while I began to hanker after something with a bit more bite, or, you know, a drum beat would have been nice. The highlight of the musical output for me is Wolf Alice with their track Blush. Lovely song, which when it finally hits its stride about 4 minutes in, is an absolute killer of a tune. Bias warning on that, I do sort of know the basis to Wolf Alice, so fame! Mr. Clive.
The VPME, the Von Pipp Musical Express. As you might expect, this is kind of, it's like an alternative New Musical Express. It's very indie. I love this. This was, it's really, really fun. The writing is good, but they do seem to kind of be able to find really interesting new artists that you won't necessarily hear on the radio. I mean, particularly, I would highlight Move Shake Hide by the Marmosets, which is like real heavy rock but with a fantastic female vocalist, and one of my favourite tracks of the year now, War by Lois and the Love, which doesn't so much kind of grab you as kind of ride over you like a massive chariot of awesomeness.
Whoa, awesomeness. Love it. Chariot. That's a good name for a band. Me next, Cracking the Road, which has the broadest remit of all the blogs that I visited and a genuinely eclectic feel to it. Again, passionate and really interested in everything that they grab hold of. And then thinking about the blog design itself, it's got an infinite scroll, so you there just seems to be this infinite sort of waft of goodness coming at you. So it's a really extensive archive. Great stuff. There's a real feast of freshness in Cracking the Road. It's my favourite, definitely recommended. I liked the scuzzy lo-fi of Spirit of America Soon. Post-apes LCD System, Ick, Squelch Fest, The World Is Over, and the breezy pop stylings of Gothenburg Trio, Catacomb.
Are we ready?
Let's go.
Real Horror Show. Yeah, this is a musical blog which is very much a personal selection. It's very eclectic, so you've got everything from kind of dance to hip-hop to soul to pop to indie. It's obviously a very kind of personal choice by the runner of Real Horror Show, and as such it obviously varies a great deal. Now, this is one of those blogs that isn't updated every single day. It's kind of, you tend to get kind of splurges of posts, kind of weekly or less or more, depending on. So they only basically put stuff up they're really excited about. My favourite track would be Taxi Cab by Misty Miller.
Okay, my last one, and one I kind of insisted on putting in the list, I'm very glad that A, it got in, and B, I got it, Pop Justice, which is the home of snarky chart pop commentary since the early aughts. It takes the supremely understandable opening position that the best pop is the finest way of spending 3 minutes that there is, but that the grot to gold ratio is higher than most, and the people involved can be deeply, deeply odd. Like the music it covers, it's strangely asymmetric, sometimes experimental, dissonant, and cheerfully, willfully absurd. You could do a lot worse than lock into their big tune feed for all the best of the new music. I'd push Michaela May's When You Say, which is a tune that's got more hooks than a fisherman's tackle box.
Are you particularly pleased with that one?
Oh, yeah, you can tell, can't you?
It's written all over your little face.
Last one from Clive.
Cruel Rhythm. This is it's a Tumblr site, so as you might expect, there's not reams and reams in writing. It tends to be loving this or banging tune by X. But to be honest, with a new music blog, sometimes that's all you want. You just want to be introduced to new music with maybe like a nice pretty picture or an animated GIF. Mm-hmm. And the enthusiasm is undeniable here. It's, as you might expect from the title, Cruel Rhythm, it's mainly dance music, but there's also kind of like the flip side of that, so you get chilled out stuff. And to be honest, that the slower stuff is the thing I responded to personally more. I love tracks like Montreal by Roosevelt, Lose You by Covey or Cove, and Happens by Sampha. Yeah, this is a nice one to look out for.
And that, my listenership, is the 50-second Flash Music Block Challenge. Hope you find something there that intrigues you. As per usual, we will be putting the links to all of those up on the blog, where it'll be sort of where it usually is, so look out for that.
Fantastic.
Cool.
And now we come to the most exciting bit.
Oh. Allow us to please introduce to the X&HT Speakeasy listenership the musical stylings of Mr. John Elliott. John, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Yeah, welcome.
Thanks.
So we're going to just begin by having some music. And this is an exclusive new track from John. From The Little Unsaid, and I guess let's take it away.
Yeah.
Swollen fields and darkened woods, I remember laying. My teeth, the bark and mud, and a filthy hunger for all under the sun. The word is love, and the word is, and the doubts lead over us, and it's down to the sea. I imagined all that noise killing me. We swam like two wishless seas in the drift of release, in the drift of our heat, and the thank you. on, it's easy.
That was lovely. That was absolutely lovely.
That was fantastic. Thank you, Sean. The Little Unsaid, playing live in the studio.
And I think that one's actually an unrecorded track.
Mm. Yeah, I did a video that I put on YouTube of that, just a kind of rough home recorded thing, but it's not, you know, properly recorded yet. So.
Cool. And the track's called?
It's called Hunger.
Cool. Very, very nice.
So, obviously, after having listened to that, you're going to immediately want to go out and download everything that John's ever recorded that Lund said.
Well, obviously.
Obviously. There are two albums available at the moment.
That's right.
The most recent is Dig for the Promise, which came out in April of this year. And previous to that, we have Someone Else's Lullaby. And, John, you're in the recording studio now, aren't you?
Yeah, well, I'm just at home, actually, just the home studio.
Nothing glamorous. We were trying to big it up.
Well, we are mixing an album that we recorded. It's a band that I'm in that's based in the Isles of Scilly, and we recorded it on the island in this sort of, like, studio that we set up out there in this little cottage. So
fantastic.
That's about as glamorous as it gets. Just on this tiny island.
So this is like the kind of proverbial 70s bands getting their head together in the country, was it?
A little bit like that, yeah, but we purely do it because one of the guys lives out there and it's it just makes sense to go out there.
It's a good excuse though, isn't it?
Yeah, right by the sea. No, it's a great place. So yeah, I'm just mixing that at the moment, so lots of time listening to loud folk music.
There are worse ways to spend your time, definitely.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I need some electronic beats for a while after, you know. It's only so much banjo you can take.
There you go, quote of the day.
I'm not really bringing it up here, alright. It is going to be good.
Heresy. Banjo heresy.
I have to say, it's the first time I've ever heard electronica described as a palate cleanser. So.
Yeah. It does work. Cleans out the ears.
Cool.
So, John, I guess the first question is, The Little Unsaid, why did you come about that kind of nom de plume? I mean, obviously, it's much more common nowadays. You get people like Bon Iver and Kindness, who are just one person, but they, you know, create this kind of mystical aura for themselves.
This whole world around
with a special name. So.
Well, yeah, it was never really supposed to be an alter ego type thing where it was just me. It's kind of always been a bit of a kind of a collective. You know, other people come and play, and I collaborate with a lot of the people on videos and albums and stuff. So it's kind of just supposed to be a name that kind of encompasses everything musical that I do. So it's always that awkward thing when you're at a gig and, you know, someone introduces you and they're kind of, well, what do I say? Do I say this is John? Do I say this is The Little Unsaid? And it always feels a little bit strange being called The Little Unsaid when it's just you on your own, you know?
Mm.
But yeah, it is just a name that encompasses all the different, you know, sort of forms it takes.
almost like a brand name.
Yeah, I'd hate to call it a brand name, but I suppose it is. We're all brands, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely.
And where did the name come from?
My friend Alex came up with it, actually, because I spent just weeks and weeks scrolling all these kind of horrible name suggestions down on a piece of paper. I can't take it seriously, you know, as soon as you think, oh, I've got to think of a band name, you just come up with ridiculous names, like the Yogurt Boys and all that stuff. It's never a good idea to try and do it yourself. But then she just came up with this thing, which is it's kind of based on...
What's wrong with the Yogurt Boys? Cultured music?
It might be already taken, you never know. I didn't do the Google check.
Cultured music? You've got to be kidding me.
Oh, I didn't spot that. That was good.
Really feel like we need to sort of set a little drummer up in the corner just to do the rim shot.
I do apologise.
No, that's very good.
So, John, I mean, when did you first start playing music? When did you first start writing your own songs?
Probably when I was about 14 or 15 or something. I was in bands as a teenager, you know, like, I suppose the rock bands, I guess you'd call them, you know, just playing in sort of like sweaty clubs and, you know, places you shouldn't be when you're 15 kind of thing.
Was there a particular kind of artist that made you think, yes, I want to do this? Or was it just like a gradual evolution for you?
Yeah, there wasn't really one. I mean, when I was really, really young, I used to listen to a lot of piano. I had piano lessons from when I was about 7, so I used to listen to a lot of like Scott Joplin and all the sort of ragtime sort of piano stuff and think, oh, that's great, I'd love to be able to do that. But then I was really bad at piano lessons and like doing exams and terrible at sight reading. It was the most humiliating experience. It's like, you know, 30-second pauses in between each note when I was doing sight reading tests and stuff. So then I got into like, you know, just all sorts of stuff, lots of 60s stuff, Pink Floyd and Beatles. Mm-hmm. So I suppose, yeah, that's what I was listening to when I was deciding to play the guitar and stuff.
Fantastic. And I mean, listening to your music today, maybe this is just kind of a false perspective because of how I've been listening to things in the order, but you seem to be kind of bringing in more electronica into what you're doing, as the little one said. Is that fair that you're kind of...
Yeah, I got really into electronic music in the past sort of year and a half or so. Started listening to a guy called Fortet, Kieran Hebden.
Yeah.
Just absorbed everything that he's ever done and thought, wow, this guy's really got something. Because it's kind of, I've always liked electronic music in clubs and stuff, like you said earlier. You know, if you go to a club, that's kind of a good place to hear electronic music. But
absolutely,
I was never sort of into listening to it at home until I had Fortet, because he's just so inventive with it. And it spans all sorts of genres, but he just happens to be making it using electronics and samples. Mm-hmm. Lots of other people like John Hopkins, who, you know, Matthew Herbert, who use sort of like found sounds where they record stuff, you know, in various locations, you know, like the sound of pigs or sound of chickens squawking, and they make it into music, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just got really fascinated by that. It's a new instrument, really, you know, it's an entirely new way of working, and kind of did the folky guitar thing for a while and thought, well, kind of had enough of that for now, to be honest. So
it is fascinating the way you've got, especially folky artists who are sort of discovering electronica and then kind of melding that into the whole sound as a whole again, sort of going back to Fortet, making something that could almost be kind of a reel or a dance, but doing it with weird found sounds and the way the music will sort of drop in and out in this very artificial way, but somehow the whole thing just beds together so beautifully.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the idea with Dig for the Promise was kind of that, bringing as much of that as I could, but still hold on to the sort of acoustic element and, you know, use acoustic instruments. There's lots of piano and strings and brass and stuff on the album as well, but have the kind of core of it being this sort of, like, electronic beats made out of, you know, the DLR, train doors closing and all that sort of stuff. And it seemed appropriate because the whole album was about London, about my experience of London, so having, you know, London make the kind of beats that start off each song seemed appropriate. But I don't know, for the next one, I've done quite a lot of time sitting in front of a laptop, and I don't know, maybe the next one's going to be different again, I don't really know yet. But
go back to more of a sort of live feel, maybe.
Maybe, yeah, I'd like to do something with a band this time, because the electronic music thing is great, but it is quite solitary. It's just, a lot of it's just you sat with, you know, hardware. Right. Yeah. It's just a bit of a lonely life.
I mean, well, you mentioned kind of collaborators and things. I mean, one of the things that, you know, I first discovered your music was I saw the video to Through the Fields by the animator King Min Chen.
Yeah.
Which is, guys, you really got to go on YouTube and check this out. It's absolutely beautiful. I mean, how do you kind of, you know, find kind of collaborators in that world? Is it through Alex, who's also a filmmaker?
Yeah, my friend Alex Horsfall, she's kind of been doing video and film stuff for me since I started making music, and it was her idea actually to get in touch with Kingman, who we sort of knew through a friend, and she kind of came up with the concept as well. She's kind of very in touch with the music in that way, so. So yeah, and that was great because Kingman, it was all done sort of over email. You know, he would just send me emails at sort of 4 a.m. saying, "Hi John, been up all night doing this. Have a look at these few frames and see what you think." And you know, and then he's going to work at 8 a.m. You know, the next day. The man's dedicated. He's an amazing artist, and yeah, the animation is beautiful. Just one of those kind of happy sort of accidents where you end up working with someone and just works, you know.
Instantly clicks.
Yeah, and he's done a few things since then. I think that was the first one that he'd done for a band. And then since then he's been doing all sorts of animation for, you know, music videos and stuff. So, yeah, he's worth checking out.
Fantastic.
He's got a great name as well, Kingman Cheng. I mean, that's one of the best names.
That's a band name unto itself.
It is powerful. It is name. Great.
Yeah.
He's a great guy.
Cool. I mean, and you know, I was just thinking back that I think I first actually met you at the Cannes Film Festival.
Short
film corner.
That's a nice thing to be able to say, isn't it?
Yeah. So it sounds like we're in some kind of, you know, kind of incredibly exclusive club.
Oh, we are.
yeah, that's right. Yeah. It was nice, and one of the good things about Cannes is that you can kind of connect up with kind of creative people. From your own country, you think you're going to go there and meet kind of people from all over the world, but actually, often what happens ironically is you end up meeting people who from around the corner who you never knew existed, and then you kind of make connections there. So, and I know Alex had a film Looking for Edward.
Looking After Edward, yeah.
Looking After Edward, and you did the music for that.
Yeah, I did. I co-wrote it as well. We wrote that together, and yeah, we just thought, you know, she entered it into the short film corner at Cannes, and it got in, and we just thought, well, might as well go.
Absolutely, it's worth doing once.
Champagne on the yacht.
And I mean, I don't know if that is available to view on YouTube, but it's.
I think I don't know actually. I think some of it is. I don't know if it all is.
But, I mean, it is a lovely, sweet film about kind of a child's view of grief, and it's just. You know, Alex is really good at kind of getting the performances from kind of non-actors and the lead child. So that's one to check out if you get the chance.
Yeah, definitely. We'll definitely be making the effort to try and dig out the best possible link for that and post it on the site. So.
Well, she's got another one that she's working on at the moment as well, which I wrote, which I think that they just had it colour graded, so it's almost finished, I think.
Cool.
But yeah, she's fantastic.
She certainly is. And I think it's now time we're going to segue into our main discussion of the evening, which is, well, evening. We're in a timeless podcast world, aren't we?
We are. It's a sort of pale, colourless light that gradually bleaches us down to bone colour, but... Here we are.
But that's an incredibly downbeat way to introduce the exciting new cover versions discussion. And to kind of gee us up and get us into that, the little unsaid, John, will be playing an exclusive cover version.
Would you like to just talk us through what you're going to be?
I don't know what I'm going to do. What should I do? I have a Nick Cave song that I could try, which I've never done before, apart from in my room.
Okay. That sounds perfect. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, it could all go horribly wrong. But then this isn't live, is it? So you could just play the Nick Cave version and just say that was me.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So which Nick Cave song are you going to play for us?
It's called We Real Cool. It's from his new album.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a good one.
episode.
I might ruin it, but let's give it a go.
Oh, it's going to be
We're getting the thumbs up from Alex, our audio god in the corner.
Nice one.
Who took your measurements from your toes to the top of your head? Yeah, you know. Who bought you new clothes and new shoes? You a book you never read. Who was it? Yeah, you know we're real cool. On the far side of the morning, who was it? Yeah, you know we're real cool. And I hope you're listening. Are you? Who was it you called the Good Shepherd? Rounding up the kids for their meal. Who chased your shadow running out behind, clinging to your high flying heels? Your high flying, high flying, high flying heels. Who was it? Yeah, you know we're real cool. On the far side of the morning, who was it? Yeah, you know. Planets down to your big blue spinning world, and heartbeats and tears and nervous laughter spilling down all over you, girl. Who was it? Yeah, you know we're real cool, and the world.
Talk about cover versions, shall we?
Yeah, let's do that. So I think we should start off by grilling our guest.
Yay!
John, when you approach a cover version as an artist, you know, what makes you choose a particular song? You know, what makes you think, that would be a good one for me? Mm-hmm. Because I mean, I'm looking at you've actually got a few cover versions up on YouTube that you've done things by. Richard Thompson, Tom Waits, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, but there's also a couple of things by Kate Bush. I mean, there's a fantastic cover of Cloud Busting, which I think everyone should check out. But it's particularly, I think, you know, if you're listening to something and it's from, and it's by artists of a different sex or with a completely different voice to you, what makes you think, oh, I could do something with this?
I think, to be honest, it's for me, it's never really a kind of a conscious decision to sort of think, oh, I'm going to do a cover of this song. I kind of, if I hear something, I get quite, I'm quite an obsessive person when it comes to music, so if I hear a track that I really like when I got into Kate Bush a few years ago, I just couldn't stop listening to The Hounds of Love, had it on repeat, drove all my housemates mad, and just kind of couldn't help but kind of, you know, just digest it constantly.
Great album.
Amazing album, and particularly that song Cloud Busting, I got really into that, and just sort of, once I've listened to things quite a few times, I can kind of just remember the lyrics easily enough to just sort of have a go at playing it. And I just sat down and tried that one, and I think it's kind of an impulsive sort of need to get inside the song more than anything. I think it's kind of I wasn't really thinking, oh, I need to do a cover of this and I better get it up on YouTube because then people might like it and that'll be good for my, you know, PR and all this sort of thing.
It's the career
which I should be thinking about, yeah, which is probably why
that just happens as a happy side effect. But
well, sometimes I think if you do a cover with the right intention, you just like that one, I tried to rework it for my voice. Obviously my voice is different to hers, and
yeah,
I tried to do it, I was looping at the time, I was using a loop station, so tried to structure it slightly differently so that it could work around a looped beat and a looped voice. And it just sort of, like, sometimes it falls into place and sometimes it doesn't. But with that one, yeah, I just kind of had this real need to kind of play the song and try and... It's a good way of figuring the song out sometimes as well. That's what happened with the Richard Thompson one you mentioned. The reason I did a cover of that was because I wanted to learn the guitar part, because it was kind of a... Yeah, he sort of... You know, his guitar playing is amazing. He flat picks,
yeah,
which is a really specific picking style, which I can't do. But I thought, oh, I'll try to learn that might be useful. And then, you know, you end up learning the song and just sort of, you know, figuring out the words and stuff. So yeah, usually for me it just comes about kind of accidentally, I think.
So if you're actually kind of changing the arrangement from how it is in the original, is it kind of, as you're kind of doing it, is it sort of an organic thing? You're then it kind of comes about because you're like, oh, actually, if I do it this way, if I play this bit slower, then that enables me to bridge into this next section, or is it all about kind of the feel of it? Or?
I think it's mostly about the feel of it, I think. I mean, I can kind of tell now if I hear a song that I won't be able to cover, I kind of just don't go near it, you know, kind of like that.
What would be an example of that?
Oh, I don't know. There was one recently that I thought about trying to do. But normally it's to do with the words. Like, I think if you can't sing the words convincingly, then you've fallen at the first hurdle, basically.
Yeah.
So there was something I was trying to do recently. I really like the song, but I just thought, I can't sing this. I can't relate to this at all. And also there have been other times when people have asked me to do a cover of something, and it's just too forced. You know, you can't... Mm-hmm. For me, anyway, I'm just not sort of... not good enough to just sort of, you know, play the part and just play anything.
Yeah, I mean, there are certain bands that will just try a cover version just to seem to be wacky, you know, when you get really sort of frowny, serious indie bands that will suddenly do their Britney Spears cover just kids, you know, we're just like the rest of you, we like our pop.
Yeah, there's a whole culture of that now as well.
Yeah.
Is it the Live Lounge?
The Live Lounge
thing?
Stuff.
That's kind of the done thing now. I'm going to play a... you know, pop song, song in my own.
Everyone seems to be covering this Drake track at the moment, and it just gets a bit wearying after, oh, I know, let's have another sort of doleful acoustic version of this boring Drake track.
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
I haven't heard that.
It's not worth it, really.
Who's Drake?
Drake is he's kind of a soulful rapper.
Right.
He's a bit mournful and weepy. And
right.
It's your go-to place for footballers. Any footballer will instantly talk about Drake.
Really?
It's just standard person.
Is he like the modern day Lightning Seeds?
Phil Collins previously held that Monica, didn't
it? Oh, that's true, yeah.
Luther Vandross and now Drake.
Yeah.
And the voice you're hearing is the sonorous tenor of Mr. Alex Perkis, who's now, who's currently off his mixer duty, so
he's currently off the clock.
We've invited him to chip in with, and he is.
Yeah. Sorry,
No, it's cool. We just want to, obviously, for the listener, they're like, who's that?
Who's throwing their voice now?
Yeah, who's that?
So
none of us are putting on a special Alex voice. There is actually a fourth person in the room.
Just sporting himself
welcome.
On the floor, actually.
Thank you. Welcome,
Alex. Yeah, it's good to have you here.
So, Rob, you've got loads and loads of notes. Why don't you share some of
I did my inevitable sit down and start screening, and I screened heavily, really, on the notion of the cover version. And, up until quite recently, the idea of the cover version would have been completely alien. You had songs, which were written by songwriters, and then you had artists that performed said songs. So, the idea of a song written by and synonymous with a musician just didn't really exist. Granted, a reading of a particular song by a particular artist could become the definitive version. Frank Sinatra, for example, was it because of the way he phrased stuff, a lot of what he did became by default the definitive version. Yeah, the way he did "I've Got You Under My Skin," there's no other way of singing it than that, despite the fact that phrasing is all him. Billie Holiday, people like that. But that kind of started to change when artists were permitted to put their own songs on their own albums, begrudgingly.
So this is the 60s?
This is the 60s. We're looking at sort of the early 60s. You know, the album itself is, I'm saying, comparatively recent. You know, it's sort of 60, 70 years old now as a known thing. But when you consider that even the first albums by the Beatles and the Stones were primarily cover version heavy, then, you know, some of their original songs were on there, but they're only really on there as kind of side two fillers, effectively. So, and as well, Lennon, the McCartney and the Glimmer Twins were kind of put together as songwriting partnerships, as well as artists in their own right. So they'd throw out songs for other artists, you know, As Tears Go by Marianne Faithfull and people like that.
But then suddenly this notion took hold, didn't it, that if you weren't writing your own material, it wasn't somehow authentic.
Yeah.
Which is saying that the Monkees really got sort of tainted with the fact that they were doing these great songs by great songwriters, but because they weren't writing it, it was suddenly fake, man.
Yeah, I mean the Monkees are an interesting one in their own right, because they started off as being effectively this sort of fake band.
Yeah,
manufactured band. But as time went on, they gradually started including their own material, and as they did so, they did, but they gained respect, but they lost their audience at the same time.
They did, but if you listen to stuff like Porpoise Song, you know, kind of like later tracks that they wrote, that they're writing themselves, there's some really good stuff there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, yeah, hey, you can't really knock the sort of perfect pop of, you know, Last Train to Clarksville or I'm a Believer, but there's definitely a lot to be said for their later things, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, people didn't, you know, there's this argument that people sort of rediscovered the Monkees of 20, 30 years after their heyday, but they were still doing fantastic readings of fantastic songs.
But to kind of have our kind of little like Monkees sort of segue there, so kind of after that kind of sort of late 60s period, then you start to get that idea, don't you, that there are kind of, there's the original version, and then people do covers. I mean, maybe the kind of first kind of really famous kind of covers album is Pin-Ups by David Bowie.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and where suddenly it became okay to do covers, because Bowie did it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the notion of it being a sort of themed thing to do as well, it's just like, these are my favourite songs, or these are songs that I think are cool, and all of a sudden, as you say, because Bowie was doing it, everyone else jumped on the bandwagon and started doing that as well.
Yeah, I mean, in recent years, you've had a lot of, you've had covers albums by artists who basically have gone back and have just revisited their kind of inspirations, you know, things from like Paul McCartney and the like, where they've gone back to those kind of early R&B songs, the things that they loved, and they've covered them, you know, and it's kind of their way of kind of getting reintroduced to their roots. So yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? It's this idea of this song as something which kind of becomes something which kind of outgrows the original songwriter and performer. When you think of cover versions, are there any kind of that particularly kind of stick in your head as like, wow, that, you know, cover versions that maybe just sort of exceed the original for you?
I was watching a Leonard Cohen documentary the other night, and obviously Hallelujah is an amazing track, and it's been covered by so many people, especially recently, you know, was it X Factor?
X Factor thing.
Yeah, and Alexandra Burke.
Yeah, but it's interesting that the phrasing that they all take for Hallelujah now is the Jeff Buckley phrasing.
Yeah.
It's not the original, which is a lot more, it's almost more of a waltz, the original.
Yeah. I mean, his version, Jeff Buckley's version for me is just, I mean, that was the first version I heard of it.
Yeah.
And it's just incredible. And it's so different, you know, when you hear Leonard Cohen's version. I mean, it's got that kind of 80s production on it, so it's very sort of, it's got the Casio keyboard.
Oh, it's got the Casio keyboard with the sort of bossa nova tempo.
But amazing that, I mean, that's the thing, I guess, there is still a great song in there, you know, an incredible song that took him years to write, and even, you know, even a Casio keyboard can't hide that, which shows how powerful that song is. And this thing I was watching of him, he was just sort of talking about, someone asked him, you know, so how do you feel about it being, you know, covered by all these people in like talent shows on TV, and it's been, you know, a pop hit for people in Denmark and stuff. And I don't know, half of me was sort of expecting him to be a bit like, oh, it's, you know, it's questioning the integrity of the song, the fact that it's been played. But he's just like, you know, amazing that the whole world is kind of singing this song in so many different ways, and he just thinks it's a magnificent thing that the song has reached so many people.
Oh, it can also be a nice source of income
I think I was going to mention.
Given that he was bankrupt, wasn't he?
Exactly.
His manager stole all his money.
You know, it's all very nice being a cult, in quotes, like artist, and, you know, and being and getting the great reviews. But if you haven't got the sales, then sometimes a really mainstream artist that maybe isn't as respected covering your song can suddenly give you not only an injection of cash, but also can just sort of bring in people. And I think that's an interesting kind of thing to sort of think about, that idea that you can. Sometimes you discover the originals, like you were saying, John, through the cover. You hear the cover and you're like, oh, that's fantastic. And then you're like, oh, he didn't write that. You know, you find out, oh, look, that's Leonard Cohen. And then you listen to the original, you discover it that way, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Buckley, I'd probably mention there for things like Song to the Siren. You know, I knew nothing about Tim Buckley until I heard the Cocteau Twins version.
This Small Coil.
This Small Coil, excuse me, yeah.
Yeah, which is beautiful.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. I mean, both Songs of the Siren by This Mortal Coil and Hell Are You by Jeff Buckley are actually two of the songs which are in a book I read as kind of preparation for this discussion, which is a book that's out at the moment called The 100 Greatest Cover Versions, the provocatively and misleadingly titled book by Robert Webb. And it's basically, it's from the columns he's written for the Independent newspaper, Story of the Song and Double Take. And he sort of admits that, you know, he can't defend all the choices as being amongst the greatest. It's just one of those kind of titles that's kind of it's deliberately ironic, should I say. But, you know, his kind of remit was to pick kind of tracks where the stories behind the songs are interesting. And that's basically, you get like a page on or two on each song, and kind of either the genesis, how it came to be written or how it came to be covered by a particular artist. And so there are kind of, as you expect, kind of the usual suspects like Nothing Compares to You by Sinead O'Connor, Tainted Love by Soft Cell, but there's also things where I'm like, I didn't even know that was a cover, like things like like For Once in My Life by Stevie Wonder, I just assumed was a Stevie Wonder song because he's, you know, famous for writing his own stuff.
Mm.
But that was the original, actually, by Jean Duchon. It was recorded by Jean Duchon in 1966. And that's where, and that's one of those kind of instances where it's that Motown thing of,
yeah,
like Berry Gordy throwing out like songs to a dozen people and seeing which one he liked best.
Yeah. Well, seeing which one goes out and sticks, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, I heard it through the grapevine, Marvin Gaye, that was not the original version that was recorded.
Oh.
The original version was recorded by The Miracles without Smokey.
I've got one. Respect. Not originally by Aretha Franklin.
There you go. So there are a few of those.
Otis Redding.
Otis Redding, yeah, exactly.
But and there's things where you just associate it with a track so strongly with a particular artist, and you just think, really? That they didn't write that because it just seems such a great fit. Like things like Step On by Happy Mondays.
Mm.
Not a Happy Mondays song.
Really?
Yeah, and written by John Congos. An artist I'm not familiar with. I must
South African artist. It was actually a one-hit wonder back in
71.
Thank you.
So, or a track like "Hello Hooray," the Alice Cooper song, not the actually a Judy Collins song.
Okay.
So you get thing. You get one of these interesting oddities, and sometimes it is the case that the original. You listen to the original, and you're like, I know. You're like, I can see why that wasn't a hit, because there's something in the arrangement isn't quite there, and when the person's covered it, they've just slightly changed the arrangement, and then sometimes it's the case where, and I've heard this with like things like Bob Dylan tracks, who's a massively covered artist, obviously.
Mm. Yeah.
Where someone has covered one of his songs, and they've changed the arrangement, and actually when he then plays it live, he actually uses their arrangement of his own song, because he's like, obviously listened to it and thought, you know what, that's quite a good...
I love that.
You know, I wrote it, why not? You know, so, that's kind of...
Yeah.
But that's an interesting point, actually, Clive. I think if you've ever heard David Bowie's cover of Pablo Picasso by Modern Lovers...
I love that song.
It's so different that you couldn't even... So, you know, the arrangement is entirely different. It's just he's effectively taken the lyrics. And, you know, it's such a blurred line as to whether it actually is a cover version or not.
Mm.
Or
yeah,
it's essentially just a complete and utter reworking of a song.
Yeah, you've got that whole sort of thing where a song becomes almost completely different. I mean, I made me think of something like Valerie by the Zootons that became completely stripped down and rebuilt as a 60s... soul track, ersatz granted, but
for Amy Winehouse.
Produced by Mark Ronson.
Yes,
smothered in brass.
Absolutely.
Smothered in brass.
it's great though, isn't it?
Mm.
I mean, another example would be something like Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes, which is completely different to the original Jackie DeShannon version.
Yeah,
and. You know, and to the point where when Jackie DeShannon first listened to it, she didn't even realise it was her song until it was like, oh, hang on, oh, hello.
Yeah, I recognise that line.
So that's kind of funny the way that can happen sometimes, you know. It's and sometimes the song is just, it almost seems like this unstoppable thing that, you know, even if the original band breaks up or there's some kind of problem getting the song out, the song finds a way. You know, it's almost like kind of literary characters like Dracula or Sherlock Holmes, where even if their creator tries to kill them, they are unkillable because people just want more of that. It's like there are certain songs, you know, that seem to have that.
Can't stop the rock, man.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, like things like, I don't know, like Without You. You know, where the original Badfinger version, I really like, but Badfinger was just one of these bands that just cursed by incredibly terrible luck, and just their story, if you read it, is an incredibly tragic one. But then the Harry Nilsson took that, slightly changed the arrangement, and it became a massive hit.
Took off, yeah.
And since then, that's been covered by squillions of people.
Yeah.
So... But that just seems like, or sometimes, you know, again, going back to Rob Webb's book, there are some interesting stories of things where maybe one person in a band has written a song and the rest of the band aren't really into it, you know, or don't really value that. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, we have to give X like a song on this album. So
also known as the Ringo factor, presumably.
Yeah, and they don't realise how good it is until someone else covers, like, say, with a little help from my friends.
Mm.
And they're like, wow, that's a pretty good song. So
still holding out for the pop soul version of Octopus's Garden. It's probably out there somewhere, isn't it?
I'm sure it must be.
I'm
looking forward to that. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's like sometimes a cover artist and a song just seems such a perfect fit, don't they? Mm. They just seem to. That's why I think sometimes you're surprised when you hear, oh, that's a cover version, because it seems to be so. The lyrics seem to be talking about that person's life, or they just seem to be so right for them. Like something like, I know, Hurt.
Would be the one that instantly springs to mind.
You know, Johnny Cash, I mean, obviously Nine Inch Nails song, which is deeply, deeply personal to Trent Reznor about his own problems with heroin and so on, and substance addiction. And then you hear that, and especially when you put it with that amazing video.
I think the two do go together, actually. It has to be that 1-2 punch of the visuals of Johnny Cash and seeing that sort of change of from the incredibly vibrant young artist down to this old man, and you just know he's just not long for this world when you watch that.
It's not just that track, there's many others coming around that time as well, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, we've already had a brilliant Nick Cave cover live from The Little Unsaid, and it makes me think of another Nick Cave cover that Johnny Cash did, The Mercy Seat,
which is
wonderful.
I think that was written for Johnny Cash. I think he wrote it with the intention of Johnny Cash playing it. Which is quite interesting as well.
That is interesting, because I mean, I love the Nick Cave version as well.
Yeah, and they still play that now. You know, I saw him about a month ago in London, and they still play that song and they play the hell out of it. You know, it's amazing.
I can imagine.
I think it's time for final thoughts on our epic discussion.
Okay, well, I think it's probably worth doing a quick round table and talk about our favourite cover versions, if we indeed have them. I'll start, and I want to. I'm going to be greedy, actually, and mention three. They are all coming from the same source. It's interesting that you mentioned Richard Thompson earlier on, because my three all come from the tribute album from Richard Thompson called "Beat the Retreat" that came out in the early 90s, I think. So the three that I'm going for are Bob Mould's rocketing version of "Turning of the Tide." X's weird angular stop-start run through Shoot Out the Lights, and probably my favourite is Loudon Wainwright and Sean Colvin's version of A Heart Needs a Home, which just chokes me up every time I hear it, and I've heard it an awful lot recently. That's my three. Oh, and Kylie's Locomotion, because it's Kylie.
I think I've kind of gone over a lot of the songs which I would mention as being my favourites already, so I guess to add to that, I really like often those kind of quirky takes where it's like, where the artist is just completely almost mangled the original song and just made it theirs, like Devo's "I Can't Get No Satisfaction," which it's funny, you listen to the original Rolling Stones version and, I mean, you know, it's a great song, but I don't really believe that he can't get any satisfaction when I hear him sing that song.
This is Mick Jagger we're talking about.
But yeah, it's kind of, it's almost like I can't get no satisfaction right now, but you know, but 10 minutes time I'll be right. But when you hear Devo, they really can't get any satisfaction. it is the most frustrated version, because it seems it's so kind of adenoidal.
It's the hat, isn't it? It's the hats that are doing it.
Oh, the hats are great, or something like "Money." That's What I Want by the Flying Lizards.
Yeah.
So it's just those kind of like weird oddities sometimes that really kind of stick, because you're like, I never could have imagined that song could become this thing.
Mm.
And I mean, sometimes you get really horrible examples of people trying to sort of crowbar a song into a different form. And, you know, or, I mean, I know you're a particular fan of William Shatner, aren't you?
Oh, the Shat, as we call him. Yeah.
Lucy in the sky with diamonds.
I found out very recently that that album, The Demolished Man, was actually recorded in an afternoon. So it's not even as if he had any interest at all. He literally went in, did his lines, picked up the suitcase full of cash and walked out and left us with this musical turd on the sidewalk. It's horrible, horrible, horrible stuff.
You're right. It's no Ballad of Bilbo Baggins.
It's, well, there we go. I mean, we're talking Leonard Nimoy there. It's the mark of quality. John, do you have a particular favourite?
I probably don't, to be honest. It's quite hard to think of one. I could name one that springs to mind, which I think is great, just because I saw I watched Windale and I again the other day, and Hendrix's All Along the Watchtower.
Yeah.
He does quite a few Bob Dylan covers, actually. Like a Rolling Stone is a really good live version of that, where he's kind of talking to the audience in between. He's saying that Bob Dylan's grandma's in the audience and stuff. All Along the Watchtower is, I'll go for that one for now.
Cool. Alex, you've got one?
Well, you two have cheated a bit because you've had time to prep up, haven't you?
Yeah.
So I was quietly scrolling through my phone in the background trying to look for something. But actually, what has sprung to mind, which I think is quite an interesting cover version, off the back of what you said, Rob, is One Man Guy, Rufus Wainwright's cover of Loudon Wainwright's, because I think it's quite interesting for him to cover a track of his father's that is presumably written with sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek about his mother. I don't know, I'm guessing.
I would guess so,
I think it's a really nice...
Loads of layers of subtext.
Yeah, exactly.
In that particular choice. No, that's a good choice.
Yeah, I think that springs up for me.
It's a lovely, great track, and he does a fantastic...
Yeah, and similarly with Kate Bush. I mean, I wasn't into Kate Bush whatsoever until Hounds of Love by Future Heads. I still think it's a really, really interesting cover version. And that's another great example of getting me into an artist I probably wouldn't have touched at all. And then, as a result, now probably love far more than I ever would the Future Heads. So I think that is a good example of that leading you on to something that you wouldn't have touched previously. Mm. Yeah.
Cool. Thanks ever so much.
Fantastic. So I think we're going to wrap things up now. Now, because we have had already been spoiled by two brilliant live tracks, and John's very kindly agreed to play a third. Yeah, we really are spoiling you, listeners.
Yeah.
There will be no Dice of Fate this week.
Sighs of disbelief and despair.
What is Dice of Fate?
The Dice of Fate is basically we like to sort of introduce a random element into. Our review section. So what we tend to do is grab 20 or 30 film titles or book titles or music titles and make a list out of it and then randomise that by throwing dice for a particular one. We've done it with a 20-sided dice. We did it memorably once with a 100-sided dice. We're not doing it this time round because we'd rather have you do another song instead.
Can't you do it while I'm playing the song? We can incorporate
they're in their vault, the Dice of Fate.
They are.
But we will tease what we are going to be doing for our January podcast, which is we're introducing a kind of a new type of show, aren't we?
We are, yes.
Other media.
So as opposed to the film, music, literary trifecta that we've been flipping around, other media and... Bearing in mind that everyone's talking at the time of recording about a certain TV show that's hit its 50th anniversary.
Yes, very much so. That will have passed by now, and we will know exactly who John Hurt is and what he is doing with all the other people in that show.
And where the hell's K-9?
Demand to be told. So we are going to be having a special Doctor Who show, and we are going to be looking at the new show with a special guest, Mr. Keith Iles, who is a new Who, what's the word?
Virgin.
Virgin skeptic, I think is a good way of putting it. He loves the classic show, but has never been able to get into the new one. So we've tried to convert him like some kind of cultural kind of cult.
Cultural cult, cultural dictators.
Yes.
Will we succeed? You'll just have to wait and find out.
And in the place of our normal review section, we will be doing a little kind of highlights of the classic series. Plus, also, we'll be picking a low light as well.
Yeah, because that's the way we like to go. We like to go high, we like to go low.
Yeah, and also, yeah, so we'll each be looking at a show which is a story which is particularly infamous for being not one of the best ones. And, yeah, and we're going to try and rediscover, going with an open heart and you know, an open mind, and hopefully we'll discover that maybe...
there's something to like in there.
Yeah, because how can you not like Doctor Who? It's fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where we go with that. Okay, so to play us out, we have The Little Unsaid. Now, before we get to the fantastic cover version... We're just going to sort of give you all the gumph you need to know about where you find out more about John's music and all that good stuff. And basically, everything is on his site, thelittleunsaid.com. You can listen to the entirety of his last album, Dig for the Promise, and you can buy music there. You can also find any new gig details posted up there.
I mean, if anything comes up between us recording and this coming out, we'll obviously be making that known on Excuses and Half-Truths.
Yeah, John is also on Bandcamp and SoundCloud and Facebook. So, and even MySpace, I didn't even realise it still existed, but there you go.
Does it still exist? I didn't even know I had one.
According to your site, you do. So if you search for The Little Unsaid at those places...
social media there, John.
There's so much to think about.
His people do that kind of thing for
absolutely.
Him. And also, we've already been kind of teasing it, but there's various videos and of John playing live on YouTube. And also, and fantastic videos like the one by Kingman Chen, which we've already talked about, for Through the Fields. So basically, yeah, to find out more, go to thelittleunsaid.com.
For a wealth of loveliness. So, John, you're going to play us out with one final cover version. Have you decided what that's going to be?
I think I am. Well, I'm in the right tuning for this Atoms for Peace song called Before Your Very Eyes. So,
fantastic.
Unless you want to put it out to the listeners, people can phone in now. Do you have a number you can give people?
Because of the timey-wimey nature of the show...
We're not live.
That's not going to happen. It seems funny talking about someone playing live on a recorded show because it's not live anymore, but it is live because John's in the room.
I could have done each one 12 times for all people to get it right.
We don't talk about it.
he hasn't, listeners.
Maybe that's one for the future, just keep you locked in the room.
Yeah.
Oh look, it's John from The Little Unsaid. What a surprise. Please let me go.
It just remains, I think, Rob, for us to thank our fantastic studio guests. We have Mr. Alex Perkis, who's been on fantastic sound duties, and also as contributing to our cover versions discussion. Thank you, sir.
Yes. I'm gonna take away the cultural cult reference as almost like a form of slang to someone.
I think that's a t-shirt.
Yeah, you cultural cult.
You cultural cult, you.
So I'm going to refer to Keith as now. That cultural cult.
He's going
to
love that.
He's so going to love it. And obviously a massive thank you to John Elliott, also known as The Little Unsaid.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming in.
Pleasure. John, please play us out.
Stomach's rumbling, I hope that's not going to affect things. You really want me.
Speak to you soon.